Hey y'all, welcome back. This is episode 2 of the Plaid Pilot Podcast, and I'm your host, Todd Weld. 111 years ago this week, Harriet Quimby became the first American woman to earn a pilot license, so today we're going to talk about her short but exciting career in aviation. I'm mostly on my own today, but joining us for the general aviation segment, we have our Aviator of the Week, Matt, from Cedar City, Utah.
You have officially joined the Camel Club, commercial airplane, multi-engine land, right?
I haven't heard of the Camel Club, but yeah, when you were doing flights and all the logbook signing and stuff, we wrote Camel in it.
So how long have you been flying?
Almost two years now, so end of 2020.
That was a good time to get into it, I guess.
Yeah.
So what's your plans for aviation? I guess obviously you got your commercial down. Are you going for CFI? Do you already have your CFI? What's the story there?
Yeah, so I've been working on my CFI for a little bit now. Real close to that as well. Real close to finishing that. And then long-term goals, I would like to go into some corporate flying, some Part 135 charter, or airlines, you know, not too picky. So wherever, really, for now.
So what got you into aviation? Have you always been into aviation, or something happened that kind of set you down that path?
Yeah, really just the real cliche answer of, you know, ever since I was a little kid, just wanted to, get on the first flight with your parents, wherever I was going, and I was like, wow, this is cool.
So you come from an aviation family then?
No, not at all. I mean, just like hopping on like Southwest or whatever with the parents, I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the first in my family to be a pilot or in the aviation community.
Okay, yeah, it's the same with me. So you're flying out of Cedar City, right?
Yep, Cedar City. I'm actually a part of the Southern Utah University aviation program. So,
are they based out there? Is it like kind of an affiliate program that you're going through?
Yeah, no, that's the main campus is here in Cedar City, and our only hangar is here. So,
okay, so that's the whole of the program is right there in Cedar City.
Yep.
Well, that's cool. Are you from that area, or did you travel to the school specifically for? From somewhere else?
Yeah, I came to this school specifically for this program. I grew up in Vegas, in Henderson, and then family moved to Boise while I was in high school. But I knew about SUU and our program before I even moved out of Vegas, so I was kind of set on this for a while, actually.
Okay, so it's something you knew you wanted to do for a long time and just finally got to a place where you could do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I knew at the time that I know this is where I wanted, because there were other programs, Embry-Riddle and whatnot, but I knew that of this, at least.
Right. Yeah, they do a good mm-hmm. job marketing. I know with the Air Force, SUU is one of the ones that they have their brochures and stuff for. Come join this program when you get out.
And one of the reasons for that probably is because SUU strongly supports using like the GI Bill and all that stuff. And they're strong supporters of it and will fight for everyone to be able to use those benefits. So
right.
There's a lot of veterans here using those GI benefits.
Okay, nice. So the it's Part 141 school, I guess, being a university.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We have a little tailwheel lab and some other fun electives, I guess. That's all 61, but the meat and potatoes, your private instrument commercial, is all 141.
Okay, nice. So what all ratings do you hold? Do you have the tailwheel endorsement? And I guess you have just about everything but the instructor ratings, right?
Yeah, I actually don't hold my tailwheel. I've had training in it, and it's a real fun aircraft to fly, the American Champions of Tabria, but, I kind of sucked at landing, so.
I hear it's not easy. I've never flown one.
Yeah, no, it's.
I've heard that they can be a handful. You gotta.
Yeah, it's great training for sure, but it'll kick your butt the first few laps in the pattern.
Yeah, I bet.
But yeah, so what I do hold, obviously commercial, single, and multi-engine, with instrument ratings, and then high performance and complex, is all built into the program too.
Okay, nice. So, are you gonna get your CFI through them, or where? Where
yep, so I've been working on the CFI through SU, yeah, been working on that. Like I said, real close to finishing up.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what's been your favorite rating so far to get?
Ooh. That's a tough one, because they all have their unique challenges, and you know, each part of it gets you know, you get to see and try new things, and it's real cool. But I would say my favorite is going to be the CFI. I mean, I don't hold it yet. As far as working on it, yeah, it's been real fun, and obviously a lot of work behind it, but it's going to pay off a lot real soon. So,
and then least favorite, if you which one just gave you the most trouble and you're glad to be done with?
Oh boy.
Or did any of them give you trouble, or you just breezed through all of them
No, I mean, there definitely was troubles. I don't know if there's, you know, CFI might also be the least favorite, because I'm just, you know, I want to be done as well, so.
There you go. No, I understand that.
I want all that hard work to be done, but it's going to pay off, so.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm working on my instrument right now, and it's definitely a love-hate relationship, so.
Yeah.
I absolutely hated it at first, and then.
Yeah, instrument at first, it's a lot of book work, which I didn't like either, so at the time, I was probably like, you know, this was over a year ago now, but at the time, I do remember, I was just like, oh my gosh, I want to be done, and.
Right. Within 2 years, you've gone from zero time then, I guess, to commercial mm-hmm. multi-engine rated. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I'll say for anyone trying to get ratings or trying to save money or do it quick is just study, right?
Yeah.
Save your time, save your money, save your instructor's time.
Right. Come to every lesson prepared.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. Cool. Well, if people want to follow along with your adventures from here on out, do you have any social media you want to share or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. My Instagram is probably where I post the most. It's going to be Matt Bordon _. I don't know if you are able to.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Cool.
For sure.
Yeah, that works.
A lot of times with the Instagram handles don't translate as well verbally. So, I'll be sure.
Sure.
I'll be sure to put the your Instagram handle in the show notes, so anybody wants to follow along, be able to do that, find your page, and congratulations again. That's awesome. It's a journey, obviously never ends, but you are definitely making your way.
Getting closer. Yep. One rating at a time.
Cool. Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming on and sharing a little bit about your experience.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
One of the really cool things about starting this podcast for me has been, it's been getting to meet fellow pilots while prepping for future episodes and stuff like that. And just getting to talk to them a little bit. So if you've recently hit an aviation milestone, or you know someone who has, and you or they would be interested in being featured as aviator or aviatrix of the week, please email me at todd@theplaidpilot.com or DM me on Instagram @theplaidpilot. There's also a Facebook page now for the podcast. If you're on that platform, feel free to like that page. Reach out over there as well. And if you have any questions or even just want to say hi, shoot me a message. I'd love to hear from you. All right, on to our topic of the day. All right, so Harriet Quimby lived a pretty incredible life. At some point, I'd like to do kind of an all-encompassing episode about her. You know, her whole life. But today we're going to focus mostly on her aviation career, which unfortunately lasted just over a year from her first flight until her untimely death. But first, I think it's important to give like kind of a quick background to understand who she was as a person. So Harriet was born probably near Coldwater, Michigan, around May 11th of 1875. You can find her birthplace listed as a lot of different places online. Arcadia Township in Michigan is probably the most popular one. But you can also find Arroyo Grande, California, and probably a few others. And there's a few reasons for that. For one, there's no early records like birth certificates or anything like that that still exist today, if they ever did. Also, after the family moved to California, her mother, Ursula, began fabricating this kind of preferred background that she wanted to become part of the family story. So she would adjust Harriet's age, and at one point the story went that Harriet had actually been educated over in Europe, which is not accurate at all. And Harriet wasn't always straightforward about her background either. She'd claimed to be born in Arroyo Grande in 1874, but in reality the family had a couple failed farms in Michigan, ended up moving to Arroyo Grande in the late 1880s. And then I believe they tried farming there as well. Didn't work out as well. And eventually we know that by 1902, the family was living in San Francisco, and Harriet had found a love of writing and become a journalist. So the year after that, 1903, she actually moved to New York. She took a job with Leslie's Illustrated Weekly, which I guess was kind of like the People magazine of its day. And she excelled in that role. They made her a drama critic. She was a travel correspondent. So she basically got paid to travel the world for them while writing about it and taking pictures. And, you know, she learned photography, which back then was a pretty big deal. And that really fed her sense of adventure, getting to see the world on the company's dime. So she does this for some years. And then in 1910, she's about 35, almost 36, she goes to the Belmont Park International Air Tournament to write about it. I guess Leslie's is running this issue of their magazine that's going to be an aviation issue. So she goes to this tournament to write about it, and she just falls in love with the idea of flying. Now, at this point, aviation is still pretty new. The Wright brothers' first flight was less than 7 years ago, and a lot of people, probably most people, actually still hadn't even seen an airplane in real life. The first air show in the world had occurred less than a year before, and the first one in the United States had just been January of the same year. So this idea of people being able to go somewhere and see all these pilots come together with their airplanes and doing things, it had to have been really cool. Obviously, Harriet wanted to get in on that. Now, Harriet, she really liked cars. She actually had, in 1908, she had purchased a Model T, a bright yellow car. People knew her for driving around, and you know, she loved the idea of racing cars and learning about them, and she was a big proponent of women learning how their own vehicles work, so if they did have them and took them to get worked on, they wouldn't be taken advantage of by the mechanics or anything like that. But so this air show, this Belmont Park air meet, it was a three-day event, and so Harriet's there, she's just falling in love with aviation. And one of the pilots competing in the event was John Moisant, and he was seen as this sort of daredevil type pilot, almost reckless at times, but an incredible pilot nonetheless. And he was a pioneer. He was the first person to offer passenger flights over the English Channel. He was a big supporter of monoplanes, which was fairly unpopular, a fairly unpopular opinion at the time. It's kind of the age of the biplane. Monoplanes had this, you know, having just the one wing instead of the two, there was this concern about their stability and that kind of thing. And he also believed strongly in the airplane's ability to be used in combat, which to this point had not been obviously a very common thing. So John and his brother Alfred, they had started up this flight school in New York, as well as this flying circus known as the Moisant International Aviators. So Harriet's here at this this air meet. And after she sees John fly, Harriet's sold. She decides she needs to learn to fly too, and so she tracks John down at the air show. And he's there with his sister Matilde, who would become a good friend of Harriet's, and asks him to teach her to fly. Now, at the time, most flight schools didn't accept women. In fact, some of the best-known aviators at the time, like Glenn Curtis and the Wright brothers, who had their own flight schools, they didn't even believe women were capable of flight. And the only reason that they would try to learn would be some sort of publicity stunt or something like that, I guess. And it was just not something that was commonly acceptable for women. So she goes up to John. So the fact that John was flying at this air meet and Harriet was there to see him fly and his school was located nearby and all these things, it was definitely a case of everything working out just right for her. To make this happen. And John and his brother, apparently they had no qualms about women learning to fly, like so many of the famous aviators of the day did. So he agrees to teach her, but because of his flying schedule and the weather, and keep in mind they're headed into November at this point, this is the very end of October, in New York. So he told her he'd have to wait until spring, which she happily agreed to. She was all good for that. She just wanted to be able to fly. Waiting wasn't a problem. Unfortunately, John was killed shortly thereafter. He was actually thrown from an airplane. He was getting ready to compete for the Michelin Cup just outside of New Orleans on New Year's Eve of the same year, and thrown from his aircraft and killed, unfortunately. As far as we know, Belmont Park Air Meet was the last time that Harriet ever talked to John. You know, so spring rolls around. Luckily, Alfred agrees that he's going to honor John's promise. He's going to teach Harriet to fly. And Matilde decided, hey, if Harriet is going to learn how to fly, I'm going to learn how to fly. And so that's what she did. So Harriet and Mathilde kind of learned together. So these two women start getting up at 4:30 every morning, going to the airfield, beginning this process of learning to fly. And up to this point, Harriet had spoken to almost no one about her plans to learn to fly. She's just been waiting all winter to get started. Obviously, there was some mixed sentiment about women flying in those days, and Harriet considered herself a journalist above all. You know, she loved her job. She didn't want to do anything that may bring bad press to Leslie's. So she kept everything quiet, and she just began writing about her experience while she's learning to fly. So after she got her license, she would have this all this material ready to go, assuming, you know, Leslie signed off on it and wanted her to publish that, or wanted to publish that for her, I guess. So that was going well. She was doing a good job keeping that kind of under wraps, early in the morning doing her flight lessons, and then after flight lessons going to work and making all that happen. And then one morning she had this small incident while landing, and luckily she wasn't injured, it wasn't serious, but it did draw enough attention from someone who witnessed the event that she ended up getting discovered. So he came over to talk to her, make sure she was okay, that kind of thing, and finds out, hey, this is a woman flying, and then he found out who she was. So now she's got to go to her boss and kind of explain the situation much sooner than she had originally planned to do. She'd kind of hoped for it to be a ask forgiveness, not permission, and now she's kind of stuck in the middle asking for both. But in another stroke of luck for Harriet, that conversation actually went really well. And the publication even agreed to reimburse her for the flight lessons. I guess they realized they'd get a lot of free advertisement from these other papers writing about this magazine that had a well-known journalist who was learning to fly. So she'd be bringing attention to the magazine. And then they didn't really have to worry about it from a competition standpoint because Harriet was the only one who was going to be able to bring that firsthand account of her flight training to the writing. So these other publications might be able to share the story, say, hey, there's this new aviatrix who writes for Leslie's Illustrated, who's learning to fly, but they couldn't provide the insight that Harriet would be able to. So they got that free advertisement and the kind of exclusive content. So it really worked out for Leslie's, and they were happy to let her continue to do that. And like I said, they agreed to reimburse her for flight training, which even back then was not a cheap endeavor. So she kind of brings this firsthand flight training experience to a series of articles that she named How a Woman Learns to Fly. So in this series, she explains the process of flight training. She's encouraging women who are interested that they should get into aviation. And it's in some of these articles where she talks about some of the topics that were really ahead of their time for pilots of the day, like personally completing a pre-flight inspection. In the early days of aviation, generally the mechanic would inspect the aircraft and the pilot would hop in and call it good. But Harriet was a huge believer in being the one to double-check, triple-check the aircraft and make sure that everything is actually good to go. She talked about using checklists and making go, no-go decisions that are, and all of these things, they're absolutely essential for pilots today. But back then, they really weren't used like they should be. So she was a firm believer that aviation was a safe activity, as long as you took the proper precautions. And I really like that because, I mean, obviously it's much safer today than it was in Harriet's time, but aviation, especially general aviation, a lot of times it still has this stigma about it or this fear around it for a lot of people. And in most cases, and certainly not all, there are some outlier cases, but when you look at accidents in aviation, it can be traced back to pilot error. And I think we find when we remove the accidents where checklist usage or improper pre-flight planning or significant factors, aviation today is incredibly safe. But anyway, off my soapbox now. So August rolls around. Harriet, she's ready for her flight test. Now, the officials that are responsible for giving the test actually refused to come out unless there was a male candidate that would be, you know, basically in that same time slot. So the school had to coordinate and make sure that that would happen just to get the official. But they got everything set up on August 1st. Harriet made her first attempt at the test, and back then, flight tests, it was a three-part test. The last part was a landing test. You basically had to put the airplane down within a certain distance of a mark on the ground. So Harry did really well on the first two parts, but on the landing, she overshot, landed too far from the mark, and basically didn't pass that day. So she had to schedule a redo for the next day. Now on August 2nd, Mathilde was also ready to go for her flight test, but she knew what it meant to Harriet professionally to be the first woman in the States to get her license. It was mostly just fun for Mathilde. She let Harriet go first, which I think is really cool. And this time, Harriet nailed the landing, and she actually set a landing accuracy record for the time. She landed within 7 feet 9 inches of the mark where she was supposed to. So after the flight, she made this comment. She said, "Flying is easier than voting." And she didn't speak publicly about women's suffrage very often. I think she was kind of afraid of alienating readers and jeopardizing her position at Leslie's with some of the fans. You know, she's kind of a well-known individual. And she seemed to prefer to fight for gender equality by simply doing the things that men in society said she couldn't do. You know, she figured if she didn't alienate that group and she could get 100% of the people, you know, no matter what side of the aisle they fell on, to see her doing these things, it would be better than being very vocal about her support of women's suffrage and losing half of that group, the half that really needed to pay attention to what she was doing. And so it's kind of a unique way that she went about that. But small quips like that, you know, flying is easier than voting, really let you know what side of that issue she stood on. So Harriet spent the next several months flying with the Moisant International Aviators around the U.S. and then even other countries. And then she was writing about her adventures for Leslie's. So now not only is she the traveling correspondent, now she's getting to participate in these air shows and air meets and write about them and take pictures. And she's getting paid to do that. So she's got a really good gig going here. But as she's overseas and she's doing some of these things, she starts to want to do something that's really noteworthy. So more than just the cool flying that she's been doing, she wants to do something very noteworthy in the aviation space that people, you know, really going to catch people's attention. And eventually she came up with a plan to be the first woman to cross the English Channel by airplane. Now, it's important to note that while it's only about 22 miles or so from England to France, and on a clear day, you can stand on one side, you can see across the channel, but it's rarely a clear day in that part of the globe, and men were still, at this point, when she's planning this, her crossing, men are still dying trying to make the crossing. Now, they were making it successfully. For example, John Moisant, before his death, he was running the first service to take passengers across the channel. So it wasn't impossible by any means, but many people were still dying. There were often low clouds, fog, choppy waters, and often if you had to put down for engine trouble or anything like that, the seas were so rough that water rescue was almost impossible. So the pilot would just drown. And even without engine trouble, when you get those low visibility situations, it was easy for pilots to get disoriented. And if you got off course and started heading in the wrong direction, it was actually possible to miss the mainland entirely. And then you'd start heading out into the North Sea. You'd run out of gas over the North Sea, and there'd be essentially no chance at rescue. Nobody would know where you went. You would just disappear. So basically, this was still a very dangerous thing for anyone to do, and Harriet wanted to be the first woman. So for this crossing, she purchased a monoplane from Louis Blériot, but when she was ready to make the crossing in April of 1912, the airplane wasn't ready yet. But luckily, Blériot said that she could just borrow one of his airplanes and was still able to make the attempt. So while she's in England, her advisor, named Gustav Hommel, he offered to teach her to use a compass, which, given the importance of staying on course and the low visibility that dominated the region, it was a super helpful thing to offer. So she took him up on that, and she learned how to use the compass, which was not a requirement for pilots in the day, which was kind of surprising when I realized that. He also offered to dress as a woman and make the flight himself, and then claim that it was her who did it, So, you know, he would be dressed as a woman, so people who saw from a distance would think that it was her. And that offer was significantly stranger, less helpful, and arguably kind of insulting. And she did not take him up on that offer. So, in another unhelpful move, this Hommel character decided that while Harriet's waiting for the right time to make the crossing, he took a woman by the name of Eleanor Treehawk Davies across the channel as a passenger in an airplane. So at the time, no woman as passenger or pilot had ever been across the channel by air. So he takes away Harriet's ability to claim the title of the first woman, period, to cross the channel by air. She could still be the first to cross as the pilot, obviously, but it still made her really angry. It's understandable why it would make her angry. It was a little bit of a low blow, and I'm not really sure what the motivation was there, if he was trying to take away her motivation and kind of save her, or what the situation was there. But it was super not cool. Anyway, on April 14th, the weather was good for a crossing, but it was a Sunday. And Harriet had promised her mother that she wouldn't fly on Sundays, so she stayed on the ground. And I think it speaks a lot to her character that even with this intense desire to set a record like this and the bad weather that was so prominent in this area, she passed up a good flying day just to keep her word to her mom. And I think that's really cool. But it definitely had some consequences. And the next day that the weather was flyable was April 16th. And I think flyable is probably a generous descriptor here. But she felt like she could make it work out. So she decided to take off from Dover, bound for Calais in France. As she headed towards France, the clouds and the fog, they start getting worse. And eventually she loses sight of the ocean below her. So she can't see anything underneath her but clouds and fog. And so she begins descending. She figures if she gets a little lower, she'll be able to see easier. As she pushes the nose of her airplane down, the engine actually floods. It starts to sputter, and luckily it recovered quickly, but kind of set her on edge. But she spots a beach, and she decides, gonna go ahead and put down there. So she puts it down on the beach of what turned out to be Artelot, France. And she was about 25 miles from where she had planned to land in Calais. But it didn't matter, because she had successfully crossed the channel. She became the first woman to fly across the English Channel. And so she was, you know, she was greeted by some kids that saw her land on the beach. Any other day of the year, this feat would have made Harriet an international hero overnight. And my history buffs are probably already, they hearing these dates, and they're picking up on what's happening. The day before her crossing, the Titanic had just sunk and killed over 1,500 people, and this is just the day previous. So you can find articles written about Harriet's channel crossing, but they're buried in the papers of the day. The front page of nearly every paper around the world, it was just telling of this huge loss of life, and understandably so. But I really think Harriet would have been a household name today, kind of like Amelia Earhart, if she'd been able to make the flight a month earlier, or really probably a month later, anything, but just right in that time, the Titanic dominated the news. So when she got home, she didn't get the parades and the fanfare that she probably deserved, and sadly, within a few months of that, she was dead. Now, before we get to that last tragic flight, I want to talk about one of the fun things that came from her flying exploits. So Harriet was one of the first, if not the first, woman to be a brand spokesperson. So there was this carbonated grape drink called VinFizz that was basically the textbook definition of great marketing for an awful product. And VinFizz has this really neat aviation kind of side story that I hope to cover in a future episode. But their big error was using pure cane sugar in the soda, which apparently required some level of refrigeration to keep from going really bad really quickly. And it was described as having this laxative effect. Someone said it was a cross between river water and horse slop, and my absolute favorite, quote, you have to sneak up on it to get it down. So just some really good soda here, it sounds like. But Harriet wore this wool-lined purple satin jumpsuit for flying. She'd actually designed herself, and it came with a pull cord to turn it into a skirt. So you fly as a jumpsuit, get out, want to go into town or whatever, you pull the cord, now you're in a skirt. And I don't know if the purple jumpsuit was a big player in Vin Fizz's decision to pick her, but it definitely lended itself well to the aesthetic. So anyway, for a short time, Harriet Quimby was the face of one of the coolest drinks you would never want to actually drink. All right, so fast forward to summer 1912, and Harriet is getting ready to fly in the third annual Boston Air Meet with her new Blériot monoplane. She's taking it up for some test flights, and she always has either a passenger or she has to use something in there for ballast, sacks of flour or whatever, because without that extra weight, the airplane was super unstable. And on one of these flights, she had a significant issue with temporary loss of control. But she was able to regain control, but, you know, obviously it was cause for alarm. So they wanted to conduct a thorough inspection. So her and her mechanic got together and they look over the entire airplane and they couldn't find anything that was obviously wrong with it. Certainly nothing that would have caused that upset in the air. So it was decided that it must have been just like a strange gust of wind or something. But they never really found what would have caused it. It could have been wind. So on July 1st, Harriet, she's all set to fly. And the organizer of the event, his name was William Willard. And he's won the coin toss, or however they decided. He's going to get to be the one who flies with her when she goes up. So they took off. For the first half of the flight, things went really well. They flew out to Boston Light, which is this lighthouse out in Boston Harbor. As they're coming back, when they're at about 1,000 feet off the ground, the airplane suddenly pitches forward and throws William out of his seat. And then, you know, people on the ground reported Harriet seemed like she was struggling with the airplane temporarily to regain control, but she never fully regained control. Eventually, she was also thrown from her seat, and then the Blériot glided down to the tidal flats where Harriet and William both lay. And the monoplane, it remained largely intact, surprisingly little damage, and unfortunately, Harriet and William were both dead. We may never know exactly what happened on that final flight. We do know seatbelts were not commonly used in airplanes at the time. We also know that her particular airplane was dangerously unstable without the weight of a passenger. William was a pretty good size man for the time. His estimated weight was over 200 pounds, and it's likely that it was just a rough spot of turbulence or something that threw him from his seat, and then with a sudden loss of all that weight, the Blériot just may have been too difficult to fly, with it being so unstable and everything, and Harriet, because of that instability and loss of control, she can't stay in her seat and she gets thrown from the aircraft. Unfortunately, we will never know exactly what happened. But we do know that Harriet had, with this flying and journalism career, she'd secured her parents' financial future, which was her top priority. And once she had finished paying off her new airplane, she had actually planned on taking a break from both flying and writing, or journalism at any rate, and had planned on writing a novel. So it's really unfortunate that she never had that opportunity to pursue that. And while she loved aviation, I think she would have considered herself a writer and a journalist first, and that's definitely where she made her earliest impacts and contributions. So Harriet had no children, no known close surviving relatives. She left a legacy, obviously, but in many ways it was a nameless one. There's been a few small acts of remembrance, though, for the impact that she had. In 1991, the Postal Service issued a 50-cent airmail stamp that features her in a purple jumpsuit with her Blériot in the background. And in 2004, she was inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame. Other than that, though, a road or two may bear her name, and plaques denote places she once lived. But she definitely makes the list of most famous and impactful people you may have never heard of. By the way, that's not an official list, but maybe I should write one. Anyway, if you want to know more about her life, and I think you should, check out the book Fearless by Dawn Dahler. I think is how you pronounce that. D-A-H-L-E-R. And I don't have any kind of affiliation with the author or publisher, but I've read the book. I thought it was a good one. Had a lot of good information. So
if you're interested, check that out. So a lot of things we tried different this week with doing a mostly solo show, bringing the Aviator of the Week on to talk, and definitely a bit shorter than last week. Let me know if you liked it, if you thought it worked, if you thought it didn't work, and maybe you shouldn't try one of those things again. This whole thing is new to me, but stick with me. We'll get it figured out together. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to the Plaid Pilot Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you didn't, shoot me an email at todd@theplaidpilot.com or DM me on Instagram @theplaidpilot. I'd love to hear your suggestions to make the show better. Y'all stay safe this week, and as my wife always says, fluffy landings.